Thanks for tuning in to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty. I'm Dave Chancellor, and for this, our December 2013 podcast, we're going to be talking about red tape. I was lucky enough to catch up with IRP affiliates Pam Hurd and Donald Moynihan, both of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, to learn more about how people interacting with social programs experience red tape, or, as they call it, administrative burden. To get started here, let's turn to Professor Hurd to learn what they mean by administrative burden.
Basically, what we're talking about when we mean administrative burden are administrative procedures, for example, that make it difficult for people to apply to a given social welfare policy program. So, for example, for Medicaid, if you apply as an individual with a low income to receive Medicaid as your health insurance for you or your child, you might need, in a given state, you might need to document your income. And that could mean going to a judge to document the amount of child support you receive, going to multiple employers to documenting your income. All of that documentation would be an example of a burden to apply to a given program to receive welfare benefits or social welfare benefits.
Professor Moynihan says that one point that's basic to understanding these concepts is that relatively minor barriers can have surprising effects on whether people take up benefits or not.
We're learning more about why this is now by looking at behavioral economics, where, you know, simply requiring people to send in an additional form might make a pretty dramatic effect on whether they access a benefit or not. And behavioral economics helps us to understand that by pointing to biases that people have, like a preference for their default status, whatever that happens to be. And in public programs, the default status is you don't receive a benefit. You have to sort of keep up with the bureaucratic demands if you're going to receive the services that you're entitled to.
Moynihan explains that as we're thinking about these barriers, we might break them up into specific kinds of costs. One of these, learning costs, is just figuring out what's involved in applying for a program, whether you're eligible, and what the size of the benefit might be. Nonprofits or other third parties can actually play an important role in reducing these learning costs. We might think about the EITC, that's the Earned Income Tax Credit, which has been so successful as a program in part because there are legions of tax preparers, both of the for-profit and the volunteer variety, that have an interest in helping people claim those benefits.
So when they get them in their office, they'll help to inform them what they're eligible for. They'll help to get them to apply for those benefits and make sure they actually get them. And so there you have someone helping you to overcome the learning costs. But in a lot of cases, we don't have that helping hand.
Once people have learned about a program, a second category of costs are what Moynihan and Hurd call compliance costs. These can come as part of an application or as part of maintaining eligibility for the program. This can be things like documenting your income or documenting who lives in your house or just turning in interim paperwork. But even after taking learning costs and compliance costs into account, Moynihan said there is another type of cost that we don't often think about.
A third type of cost that's perhaps obvious to miss is what we call psychological costs. And so they involve applying for what might be an unpopular program. So there's some level of perhaps stigma in doing that, or going to a welfare office and experiencing some level of stigma with that process, or a loss of power and autonomy when you're dealing with a worker who has a good deal of control over your status and you have relatively little control over the outcome.
The burdens imposed by this type of red tape may be particularly difficult to overcome for the low-income people for whom these programs are designed.
Generally, people living on low incomes don't have a lot of extraneous time. They have potentially very demanding work schedules, potentially transportation issues, which make it difficult oftentimes to manage those burdens.
Professor Hurd also points out that proving eligibility for some programs like Social Security Disability or Medicaid Long-Term Care is particularly difficult to the extent that some people hire a lawyer to help them navigate those processes. But if you don't have a lot of money, that's a huge cost.
Yeah, well, so the interesting thing is, right, you're trying to balance two things. On the one hand, you want people who are eligible for these programs to receive benefits. At least mostly we think we want that to happen. On the other hand, you don't want people to receive benefits who don't qualify for them, hence all of these rules. So how do you continue to have these rules to ensure that people who are eligible for these benefits actually, you know, are receiving them versus those who aren't, versus not creating a whole set of barriers?
Hurd says that one option is for state programs to make use of data that they may already have access to.
So rather than asking people to collect a million different kinds of identification to document their income, look in state records, go to the IRS, go to the state taxation agency to collect that information on behalf of participants.
One interesting example that Professor Hurd points to is in Wisconsin in 2008. They wanted to expand the pool of people eligible for Medicaid to low-income working adults, but they didn't want those adults in the program if they could get insurance through their jobs. So initially, they just asked individuals to get documentation from their employers about the insurance they had access to.
Well, it turned out to be kind of a disaster. It was really hard for individual employees to get this information from employers. And they actually saw a big reduction in Medicaid receipt among individuals because of it. So they flipped it around and they decided that the state would take on the burden instead, and the state would figure out whether or not employers were offering health insurance that people should be receiving instead of receiving Medicaid.
That sounds great, but what about the costs of doing this? If we want to keep the rules and eligibility constraints but shift the burden to the state, doesn't this get expensive?
I think it depends, to be honest. You know, oftentimes, it's relatively costless for the state to do it. They have access to these databases to begin with, versus requiring caseworkers to track down individuals applying for programs and cross-checking what documentation they have and evaluating whether the documentation is adequate or not. It still involves a fair amount of state manpower when you're still requiring the recipients to do a lot of work versus, oh, we can just mine the taxation data and figure out that's how much they're making and they qualify or they don't. That's actually pretty simple, a lot simpler than having a caseworker fish through an application and sorting out what documentation is adequate and what isn't. So, but I think it depends.
Okay, in all of this, we can see that there are costs to excessive administrative burden, but Hurd and Moynihan argue that the implications go beyond whether or not a person is able to access a program.
And our focus is mainly on the experience of the welfare state, but I think the points here are broadly true to other ways in which we experience the state. When we go to do mundane things like the Department of Motor Vehicles, a lot of our complaints about that experience, or maybe our positive assessments of that experience, will have to do with things like how difficult was it for me to find out if it was open, what time it was open, learning costs. How many forms did I have to fill out? Did I have to go into one line or two lines or three lines? The compliance costs. And whether in my experience in dealing with officials, they were sort of respectful of me, they observed a certain measure of due process in how we engaged, those sorts of psychological costs. And there the costs and benefits of that example might be a lot lower, but they still form the basis for how we as citizens experience the state.
One broader kind of implication about this is there's a lot of evidence that people who interact with a range of different means-tested programs in the U.S., so for example, TANF, have really negative interactions and consequently have a negative perception of the state, have a negative perception of government. And so that's sort of the broader issue. And we also see in those groups of people, particularly low-income individuals, they're less likely to vote. They're less likely to participate in, essentially, they're less likely to participate in an active way in our democracy.
Hurd says that as a counterfactual, we might look at political scientist Suzanne Mettler's work on the GI Bill, which offered housing and education benefits for World War II veterans. Mettler argues that the very positive experience that veterans had with the GI Bill helped make them better, more engaged citizens because it communicated to them that government was for people like them. But the GI Bill and, say, TANF for Social Security Disability are very different programs with very different stigmas attached to them. But even so, it makes sense that the way programs are implemented will make a lot of difference for those accessing them.
A lot of what we're talking about seem to be mired in the sort of murky details of administration, things like how long a form is, how many questions you're asked, what sort of documentation do you have to provide. And so historically, those sorts of decisions get delegated to the executive branch. There's not a lot of political attention to them. I think you can make the argument, especially in the last 15 years or so, there's much greater awareness of how these little details matter a lot. And as a result of that, they've sort of migrated into the political realm of decision-making.
So much of this boils down to the details of implementation. Even the best-intentioned policies can flounder when the people who hope to access programs struggle to learn about the program or get signed up. The infrastructure faults underlying the ACA rollout that we've seen in October and November of this year clearly show this point and speak to the challenge of addressing administrative burden in complex programs. Thanks to Pam Hurd and Don Moynihan for taking the time to talk about their work. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research in Poverty.